Good afternoon. Can everybody hear me okay? No? Huh? Can you hear me now? Okay, so that's just for our speakers to know that you need to speak really closely to the microphone, okay, and project. I also have a head cold, so I know that my voice is a little bit off. I'm Reverend Dr. Michelle Walsh, and I am the facilitator for this workshop, which is called Lessons of Culture, Power, and Trauma Response. So is everybody in the right space? Okay, great. And we're encouraging people to sit forward if you can, so that our speakers can engage with you. Is the mic on? Sounds like it's on. Might just be my voice. So let me pull it closer. Huh? I don't know if I can turn it up. Okay, I will just attempt to shout. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right, great. Okay. I'm very pleased that everybody came. This workshop is, I put together because we're living in times of trauma. There's been trauma for centuries and decades, but I think it's coming more to the front for people who are living in privileged circumstances, as well as people who are living in less privileged circumstances. But violence is increasing in this country. We're having more and more episodes of mass violence that's being shown on the media. At the same time, our country is built on a legacy of violence, some of which is known, much of which is not known. We also are living in a time of climate change with natural disasters happening left and right and increasing. So trauma is at the forefront of what we need to begin to learn more about in terms of our grassroots knowledge, our scientific knowledge, and what are the best practices in the aftermath of trauma. And trauma looks differently according to the cultures of the people who are experiencing it. Their lived expression. Their lived experiences with privilege, their lived experiences with oppression. One of the things that I did was I studied this for my dissertation, for my practical theology dissertation, and that's how this workshop came about. I studied the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute, which works with families in the aftermath of homicide in the greater Boston area, and they've received national recognition for their work during the former Clinton administration, as well as our own UU Trauma Response Ministry that is a national organization and has responded to multiple traumas around the country, including in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and also in the aftermath of the church shooting in Knoxville, Tennessee in 2008. That specifically was part of my study, as well as the work of the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute, which resulted in a book and a chapter in another book. For those interested, you can check it out later. I'd like to introduce our speakers, each of whom is going to speak for 10 minutes apiece, and then we're going to really turn it over to questions and interactions with the audience. Our hope is to be sharing lived experiences with the best practices in the aftermath of trauma so that you have material that you can walk away with from this workshop, as well as what are the different struggles that come around when there's cross-cultural issues in coping with trauma and its aftermath and dimensions of power in terms of privilege or experience of oppression. Okay? So let me introduce our speakers. Our first speaker will set the context and history of the UU Trauma Response Ministry. This is Reverend Susan Carlson. She is a UU clergy person and a member of the UU Trauma Response Team, and she's going to speak to the services that the UURTM provided around Hurricane Katrina and in its aftermath, but also set the historical context for the formation of the trauma response. Each participant will also say more as they want to in terms of introducing themselves. The next speaker is Dr. Ted Jones. He is a psychologist and a layperson from the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church in Knoxville and was the chair of the board in the aftermath of the church shooting there. The next speaker will be Chaplain Tina Cherry from the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute. She is the founder, president, and CEO of the Peace Institute. It is an organization dedicated to serving families in the aftermath of homicide, as I said, in the greater Boston area. And last but not least is Wayne Daly, Reverend Wayne Daly, who also works for the Peace Institute. And his title is Training and Technical Assistance Coordinator. He also has ample community-based experience in a wide range of areas. And I'll let him speak to all of those different areas. Okay? All right. So I will turn it over to Reverend Carlson.
I like that we have all your materials right here, so I can look at your license and think of you. Okay, I surely will. Okay, how is that? Is that good? All right. I'm pleased and honored to be here with you all today and with this panel of people. We got together earlier on a Zoom call and so got to meet each other in that way, but this is the first time that I'm meeting them in person, so it's just such a wonderful opportunity to be with a great group of people. I believe that I was chosen amongst all of the people that could have been chosen from the Unitarian Universalist Trauma Response Ministry. From our board, we have a number of people here today because I served a congregation on the Gulf Coast after Hurricane Katrina, served as a consulting minister with the Gulf Coast Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Gulfport, Mississippi. And I happened to also benefit from the trauma response ministry after the congregation I was serving, the Unitarian Church of Staten Island, after that whole area was hit by Superstorm Sandy. And, I imagine many of us may get tearful. I just will. But what a response that was when I was overwhelmed and hit the wall. Trauma Response Ministry was there for me and my congregation. So I'm going to speak a little bit to natural disaster. Other folks are going to speak to their experiences with violence and trauma. Michelle had asked us, one of the questions she wanted to talk about was issues for survivors. And in my experience, there are a number of issues for survivors that I have seen. I remember particularly a woman that will stay with me for the rest of my life when I was in the Gulf Coast. And she was testifying before city council about what she had been through in that storm. She still lived in her car 2 years after Katrina. And the most poignant thing, she's a Vietnamese woman, so here we're talking about issues of culture and power and trauma response. She spoke flawless English at the beginning, but as she began to talk about her experience and living in her car, and particularly the most poignant part, when she talked about going to clean herself in the shadow of the night, she broke down and reverted back to her native language and had to have an interpreter. And so I learned from that how people following the aftermath of some trauma, they have to tell their stories. They have to go through it again. And we in trauma response try to help people to be able to share their stories, but also to empower them to heal and to be able to be resilient. And this woman is just one of the foremost people that I will never forget in my life hearing her testimony. As well, I think another characteristic that often happens with survivors is that they need to give something back. They need to feel whole and feel that they are worthy and that they have done something with the terrible things that happened to them. And here I think of the congregation that I served. The Tennessee shootings happened when I was there in Gulfport, Mississippi. And that little congregation, and I do mean little, it was like 25 members, They sent a card and they sent a donation. They had nothing virtually, nothing except what somewhat the resources that were given to them after the hurricane. But they felt like they wanted to support the people in Tennessee that had been impacted. They wanted to give something of themselves and share their hope for things getting better. So those are some of the things. Now, I have heard it said, and maybe you have too, if you've been through one hurricane and another one happens, you've been through one hurricane. Same thing goes for many disasters. They're all different. There are common things that frequently happen. There are similarities, but each one is unique. And when trauma response is invited in, because we don't just go there, we don't go unless we're invited by the minister, the leadership of the congregation, the regional area, unless people are saying, we want you to come in, we need some help, then that's when we come in. And each place is so very different. The things that they need, the characteristics, the things they're struggling with are different. But in my experience with Katrina and Superstorm Sandy, there were a few things that I want to lift up that were really cultural injustice kinds of issues that people had to face. Discrimination, oppression. And one of the things that I learned after, particularly after Superstorm Sandy, but I know it was true of Katrina as well, is that the emphasis after a natural or unnatural disaster, it occurs to me that they're kind of unnatural in some ways, after they occur, most of the energy goes into homeowners, into helping homeowners recover. Well, what about in New York and in New Orleans and in much of Mississippi? What about the people that are renting places? What happens to them? You know, immigrants particularly were hard hit after Superstorm Sandy, because if they applied for services, the few that there were, then they had to risk deportation, you know? I heard many of them talking about what were some of the issues for them. Rents, if their places were renovated, then the rents were sky high. It was already unaffordable housing as it was. But then after that, they went even higher. And multiple families had to share a place. Maybe it had been a single family dwelling, but three, four, five families would sometimes stay in a one family apartment. So there were all of these kind of things, and people of color were hardest hit. I've observed that over and over. You know, we say that hurricanes and disasters, you know, hit everybody, but just like we've been saying at General Assembly, they don't hit everybody equally. If you're living in poverty or you're living with oppression, then that makes it that much harder. Another thing that happened, I was the disaster response coordinator working with the Central East region in Metro New York area after Superstorm Sandy, and We were bringing in Unitarian Universalist volunteers, and we worked with Native American communities. And some of them were, their land was right by the water. They know, we all know, they're going to get hit over and over again. But we partnered with them. We took their lead. We understood that they knew what they needed in order to recover the best. But that was one of the partnerships that we made. Oh, my goodness. Okay. All right. Well, so the other thing important to know about trauma response ministry, as I said, we don't come in unless we're invited. We are members that are ministers and lay members. We empower people in their communities to heal and to be able to access their coping skills. We have certain training that we have, that our responders have, but we don't go in and say, okay, you all should do this, you should do that. We are very much aware and listening to people and what their needs are, and our interventions and our accompaniment of them is very much according to what they need. UUs are very generous, but when you do your donations and your sharing, keep on doing it, but just don't expect that people in the midst of crisis are going to be able to give you a whole lot of feedback. I could tell you more about that. There's one thing that I want to really get across to you about what UUs can do in your congregations. The Trauma Response Ministry does a number of trainings, and we also do comprehensive congregational preparedness. And in this time, as Michelle was saying, we really need more preparation in our congregations, because if we're prepared and we're able to take care of ourselves, then we can reach out in the community. We can take the lead and partner with others like the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute, like we heard yesterday in the public assembly and the public witness about all that they're doing in New Orleans, all the organizational work, and Blue as a model for how they are working within with their own members, but also extending it outwards. And that congregational preparedness is really crucial. I just want to say one more thing, and then I will stop. We have some of these brochures, too. If you go to our booth in the exhibit hall, you will see we have a map with stars on it where we have trained responders. You will see that many of our responders are in the Northeast. Traumas do not just happen in the Northeast. That's right. We have some of these things back there. So we need more trained responders, and throughout the country, because then we're able to come to those places. There's so much more I could tell you, but my time is up. So love and compassion, those are the gifts that we bring, and a certain amount of awareness. And we're here. We're volunteers. We're not paid. So blessings. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. I think I also want to stress that the UU Trauma Response is an independent organization. There is no UUA regionalized trauma response. They are volunteers who have been doing this work for a long time now, since 2000, the 9/11. Yeah, okay. And they need our appreciation and support. And it needs deeper regionalization. Ted?
Mike, talk loud, right, get to everybody. Hi, my name's Ted Jones. I'm a psychologist by trade, but I'm here because I was president of the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church, July 28th, 2009. Speak up even more, okay. If you don't know, the brief history is a gunman came in, opened fire with a shotgun that morning. It happened to be a children's musical that we'd put on for summer camp. So there were a lot of children, adults involved. Two people were killed, eight injured. The biggest issue that trauma response helped us with was the psychological impact. He attacked the church because we were liberal. And basically it was an attack on all Unitarian Universalists. It was for our philosophy. We welcomed people of all races. We were supportive of LGBT issues, and so that's why we got shot at. So the he was quickly subdued. He's now in prison for life. But the aftermath for the church then was psychological, primarily, having been through that. There were logistical issues, a little bit about building and such. But the biggest issue is psychological, emotional trauma of having gone through a shooting in your church sanctuary, in our church sanctuary. Trauma response was there the next day. Bill Sinkford was there the next day, UUA president. Our regional, Annette Marquis from the regional UUA was there. We had tons of support. My guess is that you all sent cards and letters and money, and a bunch of you sent paper cranes. We had like 5,000 paper cranes. They were, you couldn't walk down the hall without running into paper cranes. We made a map of where we got supportive letters from, and it was, worldwide, every state in the union. And that was one of the many factors that helped us so much is your all support, whether it was, money or not, cards, letters, support, all that, really helped us with that. Plus the UUA, plus trauma response. Helped us to get in with, and the support we got from the community was amazing. Lots of churches came and helped in all kinds of different ways. Red Cross came in with their trauma folks. It became clear the first day that this was had a lot of religious overtones, and that you don't want to stereotype. You wouldn't want necessarily a Southern Baptist Christian counselor to come in and try to comfort us about being shot. The potential for that going wrong was there's a lot of potential for that going wrong. So we kind of had to vet and basically have UU counselors, psychologists, social workers, or vetted through them to make sure that they were philosophically on the same page, especially because of the context of how it all happened. So we got tons of support. It was great. The Standing on the Side of Love campaign came out of that within a year. And so, like I say, we dealt mainly with the psychological issues and psychological trauma. We ended up hiring a trauma counselor for a while. As with many of your congregations, there's a whole bunch of psychologists and social workers in your congregation. So actually, our trauma response started within 30 minutes of the shooting. Our psychologists started getting people together and saw who was upset and started getting both children and adults. We had a lot of internal trauma response that was guided. We got good consultation as they were going along about what they'd already started and how that worked. And there was a ministerial component, a philosophical component that the UUA, especially in trauma response, helped couch this, because it was, like I say, an attack on Unitarian Universalism, not just us. And having that backdrop for us, so if nothing else, I'm here to say thank you for all the support you gave us 9 years ago, because we really did feel it. Let's see, how am I doing on time? So in terms of the impact on the church, we're the same size. I talked to our senior minister. One of the impacts I kind of wrote after 2 years, kind of looking back on it, and things had basically calmed down. We went through several of the things that trauma response will tell you groups will go through, of ups and downs, and then we'll start fighting with each other at a certain point. After the honeymoon phase, then we all started fighting over money again. But eventually we got through that, and after 2 years, things were back and rolling, and generally people were not, a few people have never come back to church since because of the psychological impact. But by and large, most things have returned to normal. We look back now and we've lost all of our staff except the senior minister, Chris Bies. The administrator is gone, and there's turnover in lots of churches, but I don't know that that's a coincidence. The religious education person retired on disability after the event. The administrator left, music person left eventually, kind of dominoes. So we've been through a lot of changes, but as a congregation, we have pulled together, and some people have said we're stronger now than we ever were before. We had a huge influx in visitors. We're about the same size numerically now that we were then. though we've spun off one congregation of 100 people into a local county. So you might think that we're up 100 people, which is probably 25% more than where we were 10 years ago. So it basically made us grow, or we grew through that period rather than fall back. So 5 minutes. That's more than I thought. Ooh, cool. I could go on. But yeah, I'm not sure what else to say with that. There's group, the trauma response helped with individual processing. I think they did some one-to-one of church leadership sorts of things to help with that, and then arrange for systems to help with groups, because ministering to 300 or 400 people is difficult when you have to meet with all of them individually. So we needed to set up systems, not to mention publicity and PR and dealing with 5,000 cards and 2,000 cranes and that sort of thing. So, like I say, at this point, we've finally gone. It was interesting for me. I thought I'd been through that. I took 6 weeks off 5 years into it and said, good, I've gotten through that. 6 years out, the budgets, like we all run into, didn't have enough budget. So we said, well, we don't have enough money to pay for sextons at the front door anymore. So we're just going to let people come in. I flipped out and said, no, I can never come back there again. And so I left the church for 2 years. I talked to Chris, the minister, and said, and we talked, and it was just like, no, I just don't think I can do that. So for me, it was like 6 years out that, so I got tripped up and surprised that things were still falling. And I think that's true in trauma, is that you think you're over it, and then something hits and you realize, oh, there was another layer that I didn't realize. So I spent a nice 2 years with the Quakers, and they welcomed me in, and I had a great time worshiping with them. Quaker silent meeting is so different from what we do. I kept, nice folks, but after 2 years, I said, no, I got to go home. And I said, that's why I have to go home now. And so I came back. So I've been back about a year now. We've all learned that I should not be in a position of responsibility anymore. So I'm just kind of letting it lie, and I don't need to hang that on myself anymore. So we're good, and thank you for the support. And we've survived the attack, and we'll do what we need to get through it. Thank you.
So we have this interesting aspect here of people who provide services in the aftermath of trauma and people who are also survivors, okay? Tina is both. I also am both. You will notice that I'm wearing this button, okay? This is my goddaughter's nephew, who was 17 years old when he was shot and killed. I was immersed in providing urban ministry services for many years, which is how I first came to hear of the work of the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute and in Boston, and that their work with survivors and in the aftermath. And then I came up close and personal with Miss Tina Cherry and her work through, unfortunately, the death of my goddaughter's the murder of my goddaughter's nephew. So with that, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Reverend Walsh. Good afternoon. What an honor it is to be here with you guys. I was baptized Methodist. I practiced Catholicism all of my life. I enjoy a good revival, and I found joy at Temple Avodah in Newton. So here I am in front of you. I will tell you a quick story, and it's the story of Lewis Brown. He was 15. He was caring and compassionate. Lewis's long-term goal was to be the first African-American president of the United States. But he was concerned about the violence that was going on in his community. Lewis believed that all young people had the potential to be peacemakers regardless which side of the streets they come from. He believed that if true peace and justice was to be achieved, it would be up to his generation. Lewis was killed in a crossfire of a shootout December 20th, 1993. He was my oldest son. After being told that he was killed, he was brain dead. I left the hospital empty-handed, physically and within my soul. At that time in Boston, there were no resources or coordinated trauma response, especially for families in urban settings. I left the hospital empty-handed, physically and within my soul. Yet, we laid Lewis to rest. And as a parent, I needed to know who could raise a child to kill. Doris was a mother just like me, who tried her best to raise her son, Charles. Charles was the young man convicted of killing my son, Lewis. I saw Doris's shame, and I felt her pain. It is then I extended my heart and my hands of forgiveness, and she accepted. I need you to know that families on both sides of homicide undergo physical, emotional, and financial stress, and it leads to instability. And that has a negative impact on the entire community. In my community, we don't choose sides with victims or offenders. We are all impacted. And through my God, there are no choices. We are all his children. I needed to do something after Lewis was killed. I needed to find a way to channel my pain and anger. I needed to find a way to take this thirst of revenge that we have as human beings, and I needed to do something with it. I co-founded the Peace Institute with three goals: to teach the value of peace, to focus on the assets of my community, and to transform the way society responds to homicide. 23 years later, our work is in line with the Center for Disease Control Social Ecological Framework. In order to interrupt cycles of violence, intervention must happen at multiple levels. At the Peace Institute, three levels. First, at the family level. This is the heart of our work. Our Survivors Outreach Services provides emotional and practical support 24 to 72 hours after a homicide happens, and ongoing advocacy. Our intergenerational justice programs provides coordinated support to families of murdered victims and families whose loved ones are arrested for murder to create opportunities for healing, reconciliation, and accountability. Our Leadership Academy are workshops for families on both sides of homicide that focus on how to navigate the complexity of the criminal justice system, to access needed resources, and to advocate for themselves and for our community. Let me just share with you briefly the lessons that I've learned when responding to trauma as a woman of color, as an immigrant woman of color. Before Lewis was killed, I thought that violence was something that only happened to bad people. You guys know those type of people that you hear on the news. Well, when he was killed, I became those type of people because the media speculated he was in a gang. It was a drug deal gone bad. He was known to the police. Yet, once the press decided to go to Lewis's school, to talk to Lewis's friends, to hear who Lewis was. If you didn't know the color of his skin, you would have thought he was one of your children, one of the children from the suburbs. So when they found out that he was a good kid, that he wanted to be the first black president, then the narrative changed. And then I was told, oh, Mrs. Sherry, sorry for your loss. Unfortunately, you know, these things happen in these types of neighborhood. Well, that was the straw that broke the camel's back for me. I wonder, I couldn't blame them because before Lewis was killed, I was one of those people when I heard of a homicide. I was one of those people that said, well, you know, the media said they were known to the police, therefore you reap what you sow. And then murder knocked my door down. And I couldn't get mad at people, yet I wonder what would have happened to me and my family if Lewis was a drug dealer? What would have happened if he was gang involved? Where would my children be on their healing journey today? What would have become of me? Today, I am more aware and I'm able to talk about inequality and oppression at root causes, as root causes of violence. I've been called, and we are all called to do internal and collective work of healing, reconciliation, and accountability. As a Black Latina immigrant woman, I know I'm treated differently from my white allies who are survivors. Even though Lewis was considered a good kid, there are still stereotypes and assumptions when murder happens. It's painful for me as a Black mother that society, we accept the murder as a Black and brown children as normal, while we react to murder as white children, while we react to murder of white children as inevitable. The outpouring resources and policies, In my two decades, I've been in so many spaces where many times I am the only woman of color. I was the only woman of color when the Massachusetts legislators outlawed the death penalty in Massachusetts. And then again, when we overturned juvenile life without parole. I always say, if we have protocols and resources in place when we respond to what we consider normal violence, then our cities and towns must be able to figure out how to respond when a single homicide happens. I watched the news last night and just seeing the homicides that are happening here in New Orleans and wondering who is responding to those families. I want to just share with you a bit that I've learned through, I call her and I've dubbed her my one of my spiritual advisors, Reverend Michelle Walsh. She was attending a training, Santre Worldplay Therapy, in Arlington, Massachusetts. And I said to her, where are you going? And she says, oh, I'm going to this training that trains professionals who work in urban settings on trauma and healing. And I said, well, I'm a professional. I work in urban settings. Can I go? I'm not a social worker. And she said, yes. I walked into that room, and I was the only woman of color in that room. It was an amazing room, and there was one man. And the introduction, he said, wow, it's hard to believe that I'm the only male in a room full of women. And I sat there saying, I wonder what would happen if I said, hey, I'm the only woman of color in a room full of white people. I didn't do that. Reverend Michelle encouraged me to do it. And I said, no, I didn't want to do it because I really was there to learn. I was there to learn from professionals who had skills, who had modalities that in my community we would not benefit to provide healing. I learned Santre Worldplay Therapy. Today we adopted it at the Peace Institute as a center of healing, teaching, and learning. We're not social workers, yet we're trained, and we called it Peace Play in urban settings. That is a modality that we all have the innate ability within us to heal ourselves. And that's a tool that a lot of the retired clinicians, white retired clinicians, they have come and donated their Santre toys for us. So they have a home at the Peace Institute. I've learned this through my pain. I've learned to transform it. I understand now, by the grace of God for me, I am called and equipped to be a minister of God's peace in love, unity, faith, hope, courage, and in forgiveness. I am still an angry black woman. I am an angry Latina black woman. Yet I've learned I will not allow my anger to control me. I have gotten control of my anger. And yes, I am an angry woman. Yet, I'm a child of God, and I'm a peaceful woman. Thank you very much.
One of the things that the Peace Institute speaks to is survivors as experts, that even though we have degrees, we have all these other types of forms of education, okay, when you've been through the experience of trauma, none of that matters so much as the lived experience that you're bringing forth to the listener, all right? And the listener needs to respect that. And that is one of the pieces that I learned so much from the Peace Institute, survivors as experts. So Tina will probably not want me to say this, but she has gotten 3 honorary doctorates the last time that I counted, okay? For someone who says, you know, she's not professional. Lay people, we are professionals. We are survivors as experts, okay? Wayne.
Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me well? I'm also struggling with these allergies. So, my name is Reverend Wayne Sylvester Daly. I am an immigrant from a small island in the Caribbean called Montserrat. And I grew up in Boston during the, what they call now the Boston Miracle, when homicides was taking place almost every day. We were losing 2 to 3 young men and women in our streets. I lost one cousin in the 80s. I'm also a survivor. I lost to gun violence. I lost a cousin in the 90s, excuse me, along with numerous close friends to gun violence. I lost a cousin just recently in 2000 to gun violence. And how I came to the Peace Institute was back in the 90s when I lost 2 cousins to gun violence, or 2 close friends. And it was around the time when they were doing these peace marches. And later on, I reconnected, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as we get to it. I was also baptized Methodist. And then when we came here, we went to a Pentecostal church for a family church until my mom was able to understand Boston. Then she took me back to the Methodist church. Now, when you go from Pentecostal to Methodist, you know, it's totally different. When I got old enough to make my own decision about where I wanted to go, I went to an AME church. And I didn't know what an AME church was, African Methodist Episcopal. I'm like, don't tell me I'm going to go to an African church, Methodist, that's going to be boring like the Caribbean one that I just came from, United Methodist. It was totally different. So I got connected there. I got ordained there as a local elder at that church. And, you know, veteran of the U.S. Army during the Gulf War period. And I pastored a UCC church for about 3 years. So as Reverend Dr. Wall said, I've done many things. I think I'm just understanding as I just turned 50 in March that I know something. I sat there one day in the office. I said, after talking with Dr. Cherry, I'm like, man, I know a little something. I've been around. You know, been involved in a lot of different things. And I'm also pursuing, because God has his way of, you know, I told him I'm not going to accept the call until you send me to school and da-da-da-da, and he did the reverse. So I'm now finishing up my Master of Divinity at Andover Newton Theological School, struggling through that, and you're doing full-time work. And right now I am the training and technical assistance coordinator for the Peace Institute. So while I was pastoring it was a church called St. Mark. You know, I know Dr. Cherry's story. She came and she talked about you know, Charles, and that he's coming out, the young man who was incarcerated for the killing of her son, he's coming out. And she's not going to block him from parole. I heard the story many times. And for that moment, it connected to me. And I spoke to her and I said, Dr. Cherry, I know Charles Bowles. Good friend of mine. We played basketball together. It was an impact when that happened on a lot of us. And she said, well, good, Reverend Daly, because you're going to call all your friends and we're going to go to the court proceeding. I'm not going to block. We're going to hold him accountable. We're going to make sure that he does not end up dead when he returns. I looked at her like, this lady's crazy. I didn't say it out loud. I said it in my mind. And it happened. So I came there to the Peace Institute in that fashion of working with what she talked about, the IJP. So now I serve as the coordinator for all the work that the Peace Institute has done. Because coming from faith, even in that time when she mentioned that, and Dr. Ted talked about it, that impact, that trauma was there. I took myself right back there. I was numb. And I had blocked it for so many years, even after hearing her speak so many times. But for that moment when she mentioned his name, it took me back. And even when I lost my cousin in 2000, later on, it took me back again to that very moment. Trauma and the impact that it has on families. Can't pay your bills. You can't do anything. You can't move around. You can't function. Holidays, you get depressed. Birthdays, you get depressed. Certain smells, you get depressed. A song, you get depressed. The impact is real, and this is what the urban communities struggle through. And not just the urban communities, because violence happens everywhere, whether it's substance abuse, domestic violence, whether it's suicide. The impact of losing a loved one traumatically has an impact on the family forever. And the Peace Institute provides that inner and deep training, that space. Wherever you are, bring it, and we will help you through that moment. Get to back to taking that anger, that revenge, and turn it into power and some action to get involved. Get more involved in what's taking place in the community. We have curriculum there, the Peace Institute, that we provide for teachers, curriculum to help that teacher with that child who's impacted by violence, because that seat next to him or her is no longer a person that they used to speak to and talk to. It's empty. There's an impact there. And that child can't focus on the curriculum. And the teacher doesn't know what to do. So the teacher maybe just sends the student to the principal's office or suspends them. We have curriculum to help this. So I provide that training and technical assistance for whatever the faith community needs, organizations need, to help them with dealing with families impacted by violence. It's an everyday thing. How much time I got? How much time I got? You can't give a preacher so much time now, all right? You got to limit. You got to limit the preacher, amen? Because the preacher almost came out and I had to just kind of hold it back as to what time it was. I was about to look for a text, amen? Amen. So, gun violence. Gun violence and the impact, and it continues to happen, as Dr. Cherry says, listening to the news, even understanding that when we go back to Boston over this weekend, there have been shootings. And who's there to respond to those families who are in need? Because violence impacts both sides. The perpetrator has a family that they're praying for, hoping that this person will get out of this life, if they're in that life. And he has the other family who's impacted by that as well. They both need that space. And the faith community, we know, for the faith community, everyone turns to the faith community for help in their time of need. Because it's a safe space. It's a non-judgmental space. It's supposed to be a space so that they come in and share what they're going through. And they hope that leadership, that pastoral leadership, will provide them with the answer. Because, you know, the pastor's supposed to know how to do everything. Cook, clean, raise the money, bring the flock in. That's the pastor's role. They have to know everything. Who to connect that family to. So that is the important role that we push for the faith community to get more involved in these families. And as a pastor, having a Peace Institute as a resource to be able to refer families to, is ideal, because just preaching to them, praying for them, they need a little bit more as well to help them through that process to function again and to be that provider and that leader in their household. Amen? Amen. Thank you.
So we're going to open it up for questions, but I want to lift up common themes that I found between both of these trauma response ministries. The first was survivors as experts, that so often we think we know what survivors need, and really we need to pull back and really do a lot more listening to survivors. Another one is, again, the power of community, and in particular, a faith community, the power of sharing stories, the need for truth and honesty and understanding the complexity that trauma leaves, that a community can have multiple visions of what the story is, and all levels and layers of the story needs to be shared in community. The need for a political analysis of justice and the importance and significance to survivors in being and having that larger lens on what has happened, okay? So that they don't internalize it in a negative way, that this is somehow my fault, okay, that they bring this larger analysis to what happened. It helps a lot with empowering survivors. And then last but not least is also the power of art in memorialization and in sharing stories. So those are some common themes that I found that I have a lot more specifics in the book. We want to open it up for questions from you. And please come to the mic. I don't know if this session is being recorded, but let's use the mic, and you can direct to one or all of the panelists.
Well, this will be to Tina, and other panelists can jump in here, but a couple of observations of our experience. Fallen Church is privileged, and I mean that in multiple senses, to have a partnership with the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute, and we support the annual fundraising walk as best we can. And I walked in the rain this last Mother's Day after having had a near-fatal heart attack and stroke for 7 miles, because I wanted to thank Tina for the difference she had made in my life personally in terms of what I have learned from her about making amends in my life with some people that I needed to do it because I am nothing like a near-death experience to sharpen your focus on what's important. That said, what I really wanted to say is that, you don't have to respond to this because you are such a gracious person, but I can remember after Newtown, all of a sudden, white community to discovered gun violence. And I will say that as progressive activists, we have the attention span of gnats. I mean, we move on to the next one. And Tina's on the radio, and I remember hearing this, and she was so gentle and forgiving of our lack of awareness that there are deaths. It was right after the Boston Marathon, when there was all this focus on after Newtown, on the loss of young white children. And the differential community response, there is no one fund for Dorchester and Roxbury. There was the amount of money that outpouring of money. So and then we formed this Gun Violence Prevention Coalition. There's a bunch of activists sitting around discussing things. And a group of them said, well, we've got all these other things that are going on in our congregations and our priorities and so on and so forth, and we really have to focus on a lot of things and move on. Maybe we have to dissolve the coalition. I looked over, and there's Cindy Diggs and Tina, bless her heart, didn't say, oh, there they go again. Moving on. holy, we ain't moving from Dorchester to Roxbury. Shit. pardon me. But I just wanted you to respond to this notion of the differential awareness of violence in different communities, and say what you will. But
I think that's actually an excellent question for all parents.
I mean, I think for me, again, you know, I always say I can't get mad at you for not believing that Black lives matter. I can't. I'm not expecting you to think I'm worthy. I have to think I am worthy. And sometimes when I'm in your presence, I'm told, oh, you are so eloquent. I don't know whether to take it as an insult or a compliment. I don't say to Reverend Michelle, she's so eloquent. So I've learned, and because I've learned I have to know me, I have to value me, I have to believe I am worthy of. And it only took me years. I'm one that says I don't have the normal degrees. So there's a lot of shame and blaming. And it's also dealing with, I've learned through Visions Inc., it's also dealing with internalized oppression. It's also generational trauma that we are less worthy. It's the Willie Lynch, everything that has gone back to. So for me, it paid me, and even before Newtown, it was Columbine, Virginia Tech. Yet we are a society and a culture that our presidents say, here's a day of mourning, here's a day of healing. We all do that, and then we move on. For me, it is about God's business. There's a difference between man's justice, man's way of living, and God's way. And for me, it's a fight and a struggle every day. Because it's also, we are killing each other. The young man who convicted of killing my son is not a white suburban kid. 15 minutes living from my house, we didn't know each other. So I also have to believe his life is worthy. What is it that we are doing? How do we heal from the generational, institutional trauma that continues to happen? And by God, now we have a president that just gave a check mark for the institutional racism to come out. So as it pains me that it took 26 little children in Newtown, Connecticut to be killed, those families reached out to us. There's a connection with them because our focus is on love and healing and understanding and forgiveness. Spirit bearing witness with the spirit. So I'm not mad at you guys that your attention span is, you know, you're moving on to the next one. There's a place for you also. We all need to heal one way or another. And until we acknowledge that as individuals we're broken, battered, and bruised, and be open to the healing journey and not see it as shameful. So that's for me. I thank you for that. And, you know, our best friends are UUs. We have lots of UUs in Massachusetts. And my family also decided to go with UUs.
I do want to add that I do see this as a consequence of white supremacy, okay? White supremacy cushions us. We have this illusion that we are existing without violence, that we are safe in our communities. And that's why when we have a disruption such as what happened with Knoxville, Tennessee, it comes with this whole other added layer of shock, visceral shock, right? Because It's not expected, yet we think it's expected here in these communities that are racialized in other ways, okay? So this is white supremacy operating in us when we fail to make these connections and we fail to do this work.
Good afternoon. My name is Gordon. I'm with the Asheville UU congregation in Asheville, North Carolina. I noticed we have a large number of young people in the room today. I know that because I brought a bunch of them. Young people will come to a post-traumatic situation without modalities and without letters after their names, but with a tremendous amount of grace and energy in their heart, and way more energy than most six adults can generate for anything. So what is their role in a post-traumatic situation? What can they do that helps?
What can you do? You can be yourself. And I say that because my children are my greatest teacher. After their brother was killed, I didn't know what to do. As a mother, I was in my grief with my dead child. And I had my daughter, Alexandra, was 4, and my youngest son, Alan, was 18. I am in my grief. I have no time for my living children. There was no recipe to tell me how do I grieve and how do I raise. There was nothing. My daughter, at 4 years old, she says, you know, Ma, there are two types of pain. And as a mother, I'm looking at her, dismissing really because I am in my grief. And she says, you need to listen to me. There are two types of pain. And I said, okay, honey, what type? Tell me the pain. One, when somebody hits you and it hurts and you can see the mark. And she says, the other is when your brother is killed and your heart hurts and nobody can see it. For me, that was one of those aha moments. Oh, my God, my child is hurting. And I don't know how to help her. The next one was celebration. I would make promises as a mother, yes, honey, we're going to go to a birthday party. And then when the time came, I couldn't go. And she said to me, do you love us? And I said, of course I do, honey. She says, well, I don't think you love us. I think you loved Lewis more than you love us. Because you don't want to do anything with us anymore. Second lesson from a child. For me, I took her to a pediatrician, and he's watching her, and he's asking her questions. And then he says to me, Mrs. Sherry, I don't know how to help you. Whatever you're doing with her, keep it up. I'm like, excuse me? Whatever you're doing with her, keep it up. Well, what I didn't know I was doing, whenever she would ask a question, I would provide the space for her to say what she's feeling without shutting her down. And then because I didn't know what to do, I would say, go write and draw how you're feeling. And she would write, feeling sad. She would draw. And then she would say, can I write to Lewis in heaven? And I said, you can't write to anybody in heaven. And then her question was, well, if we can write a letter to Santa Claus in the North Pole, why can't we write to Lewis in heaven? And for me, again, wow, okay, so yes, you can write to Lewis. Piece of paper, I bought a balloon, helium balloon. She wrote a letter. Dear God, please give this to my big brother Lewis. He is the lazy one watching television and drinking milk. We put it in an envelope, tied it to the balloon, took it to the park, and she released the balloon. 2 days later, she said, I think Lewis got my letter. And I said, why? Why would you say that? Because my heart is happy and I feel good. Through that, we develop Always in My Heart, a workbook for grieving children, based on my children's teaching of me. They are the one, the young people, they siblings are survivors too. That came from them, because what they said to me and to the mothers, your relationship with our brother is different than our relationship with our brother. So to them, they grieve twice because they can't celebrate because we are too sad and depressed. So they feel that they cannot be happy. So what they did is they came together and created a very small group for siblings, because we used to meet as mothers and we would talk and we would just go on missing our child that's not here, not even thinking about them and the impact that it had on them. And they created their own group, the Peace Warriors. And what they did, us not realizing, they came up with suggestions for families. Don't compare us to our dead siblings. We are different than them. Make space for us. And they went out and they were teaching others, you guys, I am honored that you're here. Because if Lewis was alive, I wouldn't be here. Lewis in his life was my greatest teacher. My living children in their life are my greatest teachers. They say to me, Ma, we don't hear what you tell us. We watch what you do. So I commend you guys. You are not the next generation, as we so want to say. You are the future. You are not the future. You are the present. In the future, you will be us. And then there's a generation wondering. So that's the role that you take when you are here. Don't wait till you become us. Do what you're called to do now. Dr. King, Gandhi, Jesus Christ, many of the leaders started as teenagers. And then they grew up, and that's when we began to acknowledge them. So that's my word of wisdom, my gift to you. Do what you're called. Don't dismiss us, because we do know something. We do know something. Do it a bit differently. Each generation is called to leave a mark. My generation in my community, we muck things up. My generation. So I hold you guys close to my heart, and I'm honored. And I'm going to leave here hopeful because you guys are in here. There's hope for you youths because of this generation.
Thank you. I'm Linda from the congregation in Columbus, Ohio. And I'd like to learn a little bit more about how the role playing works, like what it creates space for, or what it empowers, how it empowers people, or how it functions for people.
Well, we call it peace play. That I'm going to let Reverend. Well, I'm going to say from our how we found it there. They're miniatures. I call them toys, but they're not toys. They're miniatures. And we have a room, and it represents everything in the world, from nature to monsters, creatures, stars, multi-generational religious people. They're trays, different color sands, and people really, you're invited to choose what's calling you to play in the world. And I think it's in one of the chapters that Reverend, in her book. So you're being called to play. As children, we play. we play and life happens. When we become adult, then we want to rationalize everything. And it's really, you're building a world. And the builder is the expert, or the client is the expert, not the therapist. And in the tray is really providing a containment where, again, you as the builder are telling what's happening in that world. It's here and it's here. And also, as the builder, you have the power to move what's in that world.
So it's not only telling a story, but it's about the emotions.
It's both and. It's the emotional. It's again, and sometimes for me, that is what helped me. I've yet to see a therapist. This Santra is what helped me to move from my grief and my trauma, to name it. And also grief from a divorce, which is something we don't talk about. This modality also helped me to put meaning and words when I did the victim offender dialogue with Charles Bogues. I met with him. That's what God told me to do. That is God's justice. Yet I didn't know what, how do I even begin to explain that? And so that helped me to give it name, to give it meaning, that now I'm not stuck there. I can move on to the next. So if you go on www.ldbpeaceinstitute.org, and shares a little bit about that, yet in Reverend Michelle's book is where she talks more about Santra world play.
Thanks.
Jackie Williams. I'm a member of the First Unitarian Universalist Society of Albany, and I'm also on the UU Trauma Response Ministry Board. And I'm going to ask, in the very few minutes we have left, Susan, if you could maybe speak about if a person needs to be an experienced social worker, doctor, minister, or whatever, and if not, how in the world could we expect people to go to respond to a trauma in another congregation?
That's a setup question, Jackie. Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, partly we were just talking to some people at the booth about that the other day, because I am a licensed clinical social worker, great profession. I'm an ordained clergy person, Unitarian Universalist minister. But often when we go and we respond, I don't ever put on those hats. I put on a separate trauma response hat, and it's a very different thing. You still have those skills within you. You have that ability, but mainly you're listening, and you're being present, and you're listening for what are the needs of the congregation. What are the needs of the particular people? As Ted was saying, we sometimes meet with people in different groups, like we might meet with the board. We might meet with the minister. We certainly would meet with the minister if there was one. We would meet with different lay leaders. There have been suicides that happened in a congregation of youth members or something. We would certainly meet with the youth groups then. And so all of our response is really contingent upon the particular needs. It's, as I said before, it's not like, okay, we're going to go in here and we're going to offer our expertise. We have certain trainings. We've taken like critical incident stress management. We've taken some different courses that are necessary to know some of those things. But like the Peace Institute, we know that people have their own resilience, they have their own spirit, they have their own healing, and that's what we help them to tap into, to remember, because, you know, when people are in crisis, all kinds of adrenaline, all kinds of fight or flight or freeze responses are happening, and people are just having feelings all over the place. You know, you can hear it in some of what we're talking about when we still go through it, even years and decades and a whole lifetime afterwards. And so people are feeling and they're not able to think. So this is what I used to do when something happened that was difficult for me. How can I go back to some of those things and rely on my inner guides and all? So we aren't giving people a bunch of things. We will give them resources. We've got lots of resources. But it's mainly tapping into that healing and that power of the spirit and of love that we're working with people on.
And the flip side is just because somebody has a degree doesn't mean they know anything.
Exactly.
They may drum me out of the psychology corps for saying that, but you need some, just because they have that kind of degree, they might have specialized in something else. So if you all lined up a bunch of professionals, 1 in 10 chance that they would know. Yeah, no, that we'd throw them out. Yeah. So training and experience. I mean, you need both experience and training. You don't want to have pure experience, no training. But you don't want just pure training, read a book, I know what to do kind of thing either.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just want to let one more question. You've been standing for a while. I do also want to say that each of these groups have more resources available on websites as well as contacting the organizations, including the burial guide that the Peace Institute has and various curriculums. Ted also has his unpublished book that was a tremendous resource for me of the Knoxville experience. So please do feel free to come up later and talk to them and get more information. Go ahead.
Thank you for making time for me. I'm Sarah from Baton Rouge. And over 6 weeks last summer, Baton Rouge had 3 major traumas. The Alton Sterling was killed by a police officer. 2 weeks later, there was a retaliatory ambush and killing of police officers. And then about a month later, the city and surrounding areas flooded, and about, a few 100,000 people were displaced. And so the community responses to these traumas were very different. So my question is, if there's a trauma that increases divisiveness in the city, such as Alton Sterling, it became Blue Lives versus Black Lives. And then after the other 2 traumas, there was more of a sense of community, and we're all in this together. So how do you foster that sense of community and carry it forward past the initial, honeymoon phase? And then if there's a trauma that divides the city or makes the divisiveness even more rigid, how do you just call to mind the common humanity of us all in times like that?
That's a huge question we had the whole Boston Strong thing where you had the Boston Marathon bombing and then, but not really attending to all the murders that had been going on and stuff. So
I just want to say one thing, that I read the book that you all have, Baton Rouge congregation has put together about that summer of 2016, which is a mighty piece of work. I imagine it's probably like this, which I haven't read, but all the things that your community went through and some of the healing that you did in your worship services and just your whole response, so many ways, the preaching, the newsletters, people writing poetry, all those things are still useful. And, we know something about the life cycle of a disaster. And you all just had countless numbers of disasters during that whole period. So it's coming around to anniversary time, and there's so many things with the community. I mean, you have different relationships with different organizations that I understand because I looked all on your website and everything. Some powerful work. So those partnerships, I think, are pretty, pretty key and crucial.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was going to talk about, because in Boston, what's important is the relationship. We know how law enforcement is, but it's very important that the faith community has a open, transparent relationship with the police department, and that you meet at least 2 or 3 times a year. Sit at the table and talk about issues that are taking place. We rent a place to hold our law enforcement, my Caribbean accent's all of a sudden coming out. It's very important to have that relationship with your city officials as well. I could remember being in a room after a homicide took place, a police shooting, and just being in that room and talking about that situation, and then being very transparent about what law enforcement sees as a good kill versus what we see as how could you make the determination, and being able to hold them that accountable. And while we was in that meeting, a young man showed a video of a police officer sticking a gun in another person's face who was just across the street videoing, which they can do. Of course, the law enforcement official says, oh, you know what, he's been going under the arrest, he's a good guy. And we're looking at him like, really, you're going to, well, okay, we're going to have a meeting. And they're going to pull him in, and he's going to apologize to that young man, which is what he did. So it's having those relationships to show, hey, look, everybody's not perfect. In the same duress that this law enforcement officer could be in, that kid could be traumatized just by seeing that happen. He could be traumatized. So he's taking a video of it. So there's trauma going on within every person that's taking place there. So don't validate one if you can't validate the other. We have to look at everybody on the holistic side, and having those conversations, and really getting everybody involved. Some people might not want to get involved with Black Lives Matter. Well, find your niche. You can't be all things to all people. Find your area, and hit it hard and strong, and there's a following that will be there to support you. And as being a chaplain, we have to be able to self-care for ourselves, because we're taking on a whole bunch of things from different people. And we're in the space, we're listening, we're taking on. We need also a place to dump it as well so that we can go on and carry on and be there for people.
And just to add to that, need to make sure that the victim's family that was killed by the police can bury their loved one with dignity and compassion. As the faith community, when it's a police shooting, believe it or not, our churches closed their doors to those families. Resources shut down for those families. So as the church community, how do we look and make sure that as the church or the faith community, we are not doing what man is doing? We are not saying this victim is more worthy than this victim. And sometimes somebody has to rise to really name that elephant in the room. How do we treat everyone with dignity and compassion, regardless of the circumstances surrounding that death? That's the role of the church. Whether it's a UU, Baptist, Catholic, Methodist, it is that human life. And it's that human life, and it's the families that are then dealing with the impact, and that cycle of trauma continues. Because we know research tells us when you treat families with dignity and compassion in that initial 24 to 72 hours, that healing journey becomes a little bit easier because we value that family in that initial response.
So I want to thank everybody for coming. If you feel frustrated, there's so much more to learn. I'm happy because we have to learn a lot more about trauma response, and we have to regionalize it, localize it, understand all the different nuances by culture, okay? And institutionalize it, support trauma response. Thank you.
Oh my God, Mike. I can't.
I know.